one of the three big men surrounding her. "I said no!" Dom's eyebrows rose. He'd all but discounted the woman during his initial scan because she was in a group of men, but now he tuned his ears into the conversation between the brunette and the young men, and he looked them all over more closely. The three dudes looked to Dom to be about 750 pounds worth of trouble, their muscles strained in tight T-shirts emblazoned with eagles and skulls and wolves and other nonsense. Tattoos ringed their forearms, and their leather coats lay haphazardly on three chairs at a table nearby. He scrutinized their eyes and postures and confirmed all three were either drunk or at least well on their way. Dom sized up the situation quickly. The beautiful woman didn't know these guys. She was several years older and much better dressed than they, and she looked impossibly small and painfully uncomfortable as they towered over her. Dom used his practiced powers of observation to determine the woman had arrived alone. She was on business here in D.C., perhaps, maybe staying at one of the big four-star chain hotels in the neighborhood. She'd dropped in for a late dinner and a glass of wine, and then had apparently fallen prey to a crew of steroid-addled, horny jackasses. "This is not your night, honey." Dom focused on the barrel-chested, blonde-haired man with a goatee who seemed to be doing the talking. He was the one incurring the wrath of the small brunette. He said something to her. Dom wasn't able to pick it up, but she answered him with a roll of her eyes and a shake of her head. Now the man said, "You don't gotta be a bitch about it." "I'm not being a bitch. I was trying to be nice, but you weren't listening. I sent you over a drink. The least you can do is be friendly and join us at our table." "I'm sorry. I shouldn't have accepted it. I've got an early flight tomorrow and..." "One more drink. What's it gonna hurt?" he shouted, and he loomed over her ominously. No one else at the bar had taken any interest in the conversation, except for a well-dressed gentleman at the far end, who looked on with idle curiosity. The bartenders were out of earshot, laughing it up with some other patrons. The two friends of the blonde with the goatee kept their mouths shut as he and the woman argued. Dom gave this a moment's consideration, and determined any real friends would have hustled their buddy away from this confrontation and told him he was acting like a jerk. So the fact that these two were holding their tongues indicated to Caruso the blonde was the alpha of the trio. The brunette tried to ignore the young tough. She flipped her bill over, then pulled out her wallet and put a couple twenties on the bar. She attempted to push her bar stool back to stand up, but the man behind her didn't move. The blonde with the goatee put his hand on her back, keeping her right where she was. He said, "Where you going? You gotta do a shot." Dom swigged the last of his beer, threw his own cash on the bar, and then stepped forward into the fray. 13. Dom placed his hand gently on the bearded blonde's chest and leaned in close as if to shout over the music and the din of the crowd. He kept a faint smile on his face as he said, "Hey, buddy, you asked, she answered. Let this one go. Don't sweat it, you'll catch the next one." Dom's demeanor was unsettling, confusing to the bigger, younger man. Was this stranger threatening him? With a smile on his face? Who the fuck was this guy? "Who the fuck are you?" Dom thought he detected Michigan in the man's voice. "Nobody. How about you let me buy you a whiskey? What are you drinking? Evan Williams? Big spender." Dom held his hand up for the bartender and flashed a quick look at the brunette. He was hoping she'd understand that his look meant go. Now. But she just stood there. One of the other big men grabbed Dom by the shoulder and spun him around. Dom found himself looking straight ahead into the muscular chest of the young man. His eyes tracked up, and he smiled. "Take it easy. I was just telling your buddy that I'm picking up this round." The woman backed away from the bar now, and she put her purse on her shoulder, but she did not walk to the door. She just stared at the dark-haired man who'd come to her rescue, unsure what to say or do. The blonde man with the goatee spun Dom back around to him, using Dom's shoulder again as if it were a door handle and causing his bruised ribs to spasm in pain. "Nobody was talking to you, asshole. Stay out of this." Dom sighed a little. He knew he should disengage. These people meant nothing. This wasn't some back alley in a third world hellhole. This woman wasn't in real danger. If she started yelling, surely some other man would eventually get off his ass and come over to defend her honor. But Dom couldn't help himself. He stood his ground. The blonde said, "Seriously, bro? You want a piece of me?" Dom knew the question was asked as a provocation, but he considered it carefully. "Do I want a piece of you?" he asked himself. He had to be honest. Yeah. A piece of this jackass was exactly what he wanted. It wasn't mature or professional, but Dom was in that kind of mood. As much as he knew he could get himself out of this without resorting to violence, he did not disengage. The blonde man smiled, showing teeth stained with chewing tobacco. To Dom, he looked like a guy who realized he wasn't getting laid tonight, but was just as happy, if not happier, to discover he was going to at least get to punch a man in the face. A nice conciliation prize for a guy like him. Dom added, "She and I are walking out the front door. You boys should stay right here." The blonde said, "You walk out that door with her, and I'm gonna follow you out and break your pencil neck." Dom didn't think he had a pencil neck, but he didn't dispute the point. Instead, he just turned, took the brunette by the arm, and said, "Let's go." As he walked by the two big men who'd been standing close behind him, one of them jolted at him suddenly, his fist up and high like he was about to pound Dominic in the jaw. He threw the fist, but stopped it an inch from Dom's face. Dom didn't even flinch. He knew this guy wouldn't sucker punch him, because the alpha of the group had already claimed him as his prize. He just gave the man a little smile and kept walking. The big man with his fist held in the air was taken aback. He was used to smaller men cowering under his threats. He recovered quickly and turned to bluster. Gleefully, he said, "Shane's gonna kick your ass. It's gonna be a one-hit fight, bitch." Dom just continued toward the door with the girl in tow, and the three big men rushed to grab their coats. As Dom walked past the end of the bar, he noticed the distinguished gentleman in the nice suit sitting alone. He had turned away. He stared down into his Manhattan, though Dom was certain the man had seen and heard everything. From behind him, he heard the man call out again, "A one-hit fight!" Moments later, Caruso, the girl, and the three tattooed men in leather jackets were standing on the dark sidewalk in front of the pig. A few couples passed them by, uninterested in or unaware of the impending trouble. The blonde with the goatee squared off in front of Caruso, his nostrils pulsating as the adrenaline rush of the moment sped up his breathing. The girl said exactly what Dom expected her to say. "Please, don't do this for me." Caruso did not reply. He only smiled at her a little. It wasn't about the girl anymore. He faced the big man, while the other two stood behind their leader. "One-hit fight!" The guy said it again. Dom wondered if he ever said anything else. "Shut up, Doyle. You too, Joey. This asshole's all mine," replied the blonde with the goatee. Dom maintained a relaxed exterior. On the inside, he was already chastising himself for not de-escalating this situation. He forced himself to make one more half-hearted attempt. "So, Shane, any chance you want to just call it a night?" "I'm gonna beat the fuck out of you." Dom did not reply. He knew Arik Yacobi would not have been proud of him at all, and this only made him madder at himself. Shane was going to suffer for Dom's anger. Shane ambled forward nonchalantly, and Dom saw that he was trying to close the distance he needed to take him down with a single punch. Dom let him close. kept his hands down to his sides and his shoulders relaxed. Even when the big blonde adjusted his stance, stepping one foot out and the other back, getting himself ready to throw a jab, Dom continued to portray the air of one oblivious to what was about to happen. Dom wasn't oblivious, however. He was reading all the tells. Shane was clearly a trained boxer, right-handed, going for a headshot, and his plan was to drop his opponent, no doubt with one shot to the jaw to impress his buddies. Dom took a half-calming breath, his eyes unfixed on anything, but all his senses primed for the attack to come. Doyle shouted once again, "A one-hit fight!" Shane's right hand was down by his side, but Dom noted the instant it morphed into a massive square fist. When the fist fired up at Dom's face, he was prepared to bob away from it, but instead he used his speed to bring his left elbow up to the side of his head as he swiveled his torso. The punch glanced off the high elbow and was deflected by Dom's spin, knocking Shane's arm across his own body and causing him to lose his balance since he'd thrown all his weight behind the jab. Dom continued his spin by stepping across his body with his left leg, picking up speed as he rotated in place, whipping his own right arm out away from his body and launching it in a 360-degree arc, a blur of knuckles and leather jacket that fanned through the night air. Dominic's spinning back fist struck perfectly against the big bearded man's jaw, the wet splat of bone on bone with flesh caught between echoed off the front windows of the pub. Shane's head jacked to the left and his legs gave out, as if a switch had been thrown and all muscles holding him upright had just been shut down for the evening. Shane crumpled to the sidewalk awkwardly as his two big friends stood stupefied. Dom looked up at Doyle.
"What do you know? You were right."
As Dom expected, Doyle was the next to attack. He telegraphed his movements as he charged. He was a lefty. He planned a hook as soon as he got in striking distance. But Dom stepped diagonally into the hook, parried it with his forearm, and then backed up into Doyle's advance. Dom drove his head back into Doyle's face, then took his left arm and used it to throw the big man over his back, slamming him down on the sidewalk with incredible force. The air bellowed from Doyle's lungs with the impact, and he gasped like a fish on a dock, desperate to fill his lungs back. The third big man, Joey, hadn't said much of anything. He seemed to be in some shock that his two friends were lying on their backs in front of him, but he kept his focus on the man who had put them there. He raised his hands into fists and moved closer. Dom said, "You don't have to do this, Joey. Shane's your boss, isn't he?"
"Yeah."
"Construction?"
"Large appliance delivery."
"Large appliance delivery," Dom repeated, as if this should have been obvious. "Then, he's going to be off work for a couple of weeks. Doyle, too. He'll be pissed you didn't stand up for him after he and Doyle went down, but at least this way you can generate some income for him while he's out." Joey seemed to consider this. He actually weighed the pros and cons. Finally, he gave a half shrug.
"He won't see it like that. He's not that great a businessman."
"Then find a new boss," Dom said.
"Tough economy."
Dom regarded the statement.
"True.
I guess he better just let me pound the shit out of you." Before he got the last words out, Joey charged forward. Dom was surprised by the man's sudden speed and intensity, and the attacker managed to get inside of Dom's punch and wrap his arms around Dom's arms, pinning them high over his head. Dom's bruised ribs cried in agony, and the muscles around them seized. His back spasmed from his shoulder blades to his tailbone. The big man lifted him in the air with ease. Dom had no doubt he was one hell of a large appliance delivery man. As Dom felt himself go inverted behind Joey's head, he pushed out of the hold, then kicked harder, away through the air behind his attacker. He landed on his feet, unsteady and in pain, but perfectly positioned when Joey turned to find the man he had just tossed like a rag doll an instant before, now facing him in a fighting stance.
Dom punched the man hard in the nose. His head snapped back, but quickly returned to neutral. His nose was red, but he showed no sign of any physical deficit from taking a hard jab to the snot box. Joey smiled at Dom, as if to say, "That's all you've got?" Dom answered the unasked question by firing out another jab, but this time he extended his fingers, turning his fist into a spear, and he gouged into the big man's solar plexus, then followed with a spear from his left hand into Joey's throat, just enough to put him on his back, rolling in the street in a coughing fit, 5 feet away from Shane, who was still out cold, and Doyle, who had rolled onto his hands and knees, but was still gasping in search of air to replenish his empty lungs. Don stood in the middle and regarded his handiwork. He knew Arik wouldn't have been proud of his student's inability to move away from an avoidable threat. But Arik couldn't have faulted his fighting skills. He'd taught Dom a lot in a month of daily grappling and training, and Dom had put it to use. After a moment, however, he remembered this altercation had involved a woman. He looked around for her and found her standing by the curb. This wasn't his first bar fight over a female. He knew the brunette would either be repulsed by the fight and think as little of Dom as she did of the men he was trying to protect her from. In that case, she would walk away quickly now that it was over. Or else she would be drawn to him. She would latch on, and she wouldn't be going anywhere without her brave defender. He looked up the sidewalk to see which one this girl was going to be. He saw her standing there in the night, her arms crossed tightly over her body, shielding herself from the fight in front of her. She said, "That was honorable, what you did, trying to talk the one guy out of it." "He didn't want it any more than I did. He was just obligated. Boys' rules." She nodded, said, "Thank you. Don't mention it. I really thought chivalry was dead." "It's in intensive care. Occasional signs of life." She smiled, batted her eyes. He saw what was going on behind the eyes. She was sizing up this situation. Bar fights and strangers coming to her aid weren't the sort of thing that happened to her. "I'm Monica." "Dominic." They shook hands. Dom turned to head back to his place, doing his best to hide the fact his ribs and back were killing him, but she didn't let him get 25 feet before she caught up to him. "I hate to sound trite, but would you let me buy you a drink? Seems the least I could do." Dom jerked his head toward the pig. The windows were full of patrons and employees staring at the three big men on the sidewalk and the smaller man who'd put them there. "I'm gonna go out on a limb and say I'm not welcome back in there tonight." "We can go to the bar at my hotel. I'm at the Lowe's Madison. It's right around the corner." Dom sighed a little, but he didn't let it show. His designs on mindless sex tonight had fallen by the wayside the moment the bear hug flip aggravated the pain in his badly bruised ribs. As beautiful as the woman in front of him was, at the moment he felt more passionate about going home for a short-term relationship with a bag of ice. "I'll walk you back to your hotel," he said, "just in case those guys manage to put themselves back together and hit the streets looking for mischief. But then I'm gonna call it a night." Monica seemed a little crestfallen. She just nodded without replying. Dom figured it upped his cachet with her even more. Once she got over the embarrassment of rejection, she would take his rebuff as chivalry. 14. The Economy Inn in Richmond, Virginia, was a locally owned and operated establishment, although it did its best to trick travelers passing under its sign on Interstate 64 into thinking it was part of a well-known and similarly named national two-star chain. Anyone fooled into stopping for the night, thinking they would find some standard of at least minimal quality, would be disappointed as soon as they were buzzed into the tiny lobby.
The bait-and-switch sign over the interstate had clearly been the main marketing focus of the owners, because the property itself was an unapologetic dump. Cheap furniture, old and threadbare carpeting, and a sour smell greeted anyone entering the three-story motor court-style hotel's common area, and the rooms themselves were no better. The inn was less than 15% occupied, but two middle-aged men sat together on a lumpy bed in room 309, anxiously smoking cigarettes and looking at their mobile phones. Both men were big. One was an ex-tight end at Virginia Tech, though that had been 22 years earlier, and since then his job at an auto parts retailer required him lifting nothing heavier than the occasional car battery. And the other man was just fat. He'd never done much of anything sports-related. Just a young nerd who'd morphed quite naturally and comfortably into a middle-aged sloth. The tight end illuminated the screen on his phone for the 20th time in the past 30 minutes. 10:58. Where the hell is this mother? A soft knock at the door caused both men to sit bolt upright. The fat nerd stood and took a step back away from it, and the tight end stood and looked through the peephole in the door. He nodded to his cohort, then slowly opened it. A small, young-looking man stood in the dim of the third-floor landing. He was alone. His dark eyes seemed wide and terrified as he looked up to the man filling the doorway. You are Mr. White? His accent was French. Behind the tight end in the doorway, the fat man by the bathroom door said, "That's me." "You were Mr. Black?" The small man on the landing looked back and forth quickly between the two men. He seemed like he might turn around and run away. Instead, he said, I do not understand, Mr. White. We had an agreement. You were to be alone. The tight end grabbed him by the collar and led, not quite pulled him inside the room. He kicked the door shut behind him. Mr. White said, "Relax. I brought a friend just in case you brought anyone with you or tried anything funny. He's gonna search you for a wire." The tight end had the young man against the wall a second later, and he pulled off the man's backpack and tossed it on the bed, then felt under his jacket, raking his hands all over. The young foreign man said, "A wire? What does this mean?" His voice cracked as he spoke. He looked and acted petrified, and this relaxed the two Americans considerably. "Just calm down," White said. "You understand my predicament here. I have to make certain you aren't a Fed." "But you know me. We have been communicating for over a year." "And you know me, Black. I'm taking a big fucking risk meeting you like this. I don't know, this isn't some kind of a sting. My buddy is gonna make sure you're legit, and then we can get down to business." The tight end lifted the man's shirt and realized the foreigner couldn't be 120 pounds soaking wet. He turned around to face White. "He's clean." "Come on, man. You forgot to check his bag." "Oh, right." He opened the backpack, pulled out a thin Toshiba computer, a mobile phone, and some power cables. He turned the bag upside down and shook it over the bed, but nothing else came out. "Good," said White. "Have a seat." The foreign man sat down at the little chair by the desk, and White sat back on the bed. They were less than 5 feet apart in the tiny room. The tight end stood by the door, looking down on the both of them. Mr. Black put his hands on his knees as if to steady himself or to fight off a wave of nausea. "You okay?" asked White.
"Would it be okay if your friend waited outside while we conduct business? I am sorry, but I am a little nervous about this."
White just smiled, lit another cigarette, and nodded to his friend.
"Eddie, go out and have a smoke."
He looked at the small foreign man in front of him. "I'll shout if I need something." Eddie said, "I'll be right outside." The big tight end left through the door, pulling his cigarettes and lighter off the table as he exited. Mr. White's name was not White, it was Philip McKell. He was a systems infrastructure analyst for L3 Communications Corp., a government contractor that worked, like Booz Allen Hamilton, on the U.S. government's classified intelligence networks. He was an expert on JWICS infrastructure, and he held the top-secret security clearance. He'd met Black, in the virtual world anyway, in an online technology forum a year earlier. The relationship started with a few comments under each other's postings, but soon Mikkel realized the two shared many interests. At first, the man he came to know as Black claimed to be a university student interested in all things related to America and computer science. But over time, Black revealed during private encrypted chats to Mikkel that he was, in fact, a French national, and most interestingly to Mikkel, he was a member of Anonymous, the largest and most infamous worldwide hacktivist group. Mikkel was disbelieving at first, but when Black told him, again, privately, about an upcoming anonymous computer denial-of-service attack on the websites of the British government, and then the attack actually happened, Mikkel realized he was in communication with the real deal, an actual anonymous hacktivist. Mikkel knew he shouldn't have continued the online relationship. He was already violating company regulations by having an online identity and communicating with others on technical forums. If L3 found out he'd engaged in private chats with an anonymous member, he'd be fired on the spot and stripped of his security clearance. But Mikkel saw in Black a potential payday. There was a reward for information leading to the arrest of members of Black's organization, and Mikkel knew people collecting the reward could remain nameless. This was an attempt to protect traitors to the anonymous organization, but Mikkel thought he might be able to collect a reward for turning Black in to the authorities, so he remained in contact with the Frenchman. Early on, he realized he had nothing tangible whatsoever on the man, and attempted to cultivate more of a friendship in the hopes of learning real information about his identity. That, he felt certain, would earn him a big payoff. Unfortunately for Philip Mikkel, however, his priorities changed when he lost his job at L3 and his coveted security clearance after a surprise spot audit of his home computer turned up a record of his online forum postings. Mikkel argued that he did not share classified information about government networks, and all his correspondence online was kept to a general open-source level. But the investigators didn't see it like that. Sharing any details about his work was a violation of his security clearance, and then, with the pulled clearance, came the loss of his job on secure networks. He was actually told by the chief government investigator on his case, "You'll never work in this town again." After he lost his job, he quickly became desperate for money. He tried harder to get Black to reveal his identity so he could collect the reward. He even shared information about himself. It hardly mattered now that his clearance had been yanked. But when Black didn't budge, Mikkel decided he'd earn money by working the opposite end of this equation. The out-of-work American actually made a proposal to Black. He told him he could give Anonymous information about the inner workings of U.S. government networks. His thinking was that Black's organization might pay for technical help in designing its own direct denial-of-service attack on Washington, D.C. Black promised he'd ask his higher-ups what they thought it was worth, and then, a few days later, he came back to Mikkel with a shocking counterproposal. Anonymous wanted to conduct an actual infiltration of the JWICS top-secret Interlink TS network, and wanted Mikkel to build the infiltration agent software to do it. Mikkel laughed when he read Black's request, and he quickly typed back it was impossible. Since the top-secret network was not accessible via standard internet access, unless one had access to a virtual private network. Mikkel wasn't on a VPN when he worked for L3, and he sure as hell wasn't now. Someone would have to physically breach the network by sitting at a computer on the system to load the software. Anonymous hackers couldn't do it from some basement in France or Germany. Black replied, quite simply, "That's our problem, not yours. If you build the infiltration agent, we'll find someone to upload it. For your work, you will be paid $3 million. From that second on, Mikkel thought of nothing but all that money and how he could get his hands on it. He set up an account in Dubai and gave the account and routing numbers to Black, and within hours, $100,000 had been deposited into the account as earnest money. Satisfied he was dealing with people who could and would fulfill their end of the bargain, Philip Mikkel locked himself in his house and ate nothing but pizza delivery for nearly 6 weeks while he worked on his code for the infiltration agent. Mikkel knew the U.S. intelligence infrastructure back to front, and through this knowledge he was aware of the physical drive locations where top-secret information was kept. The key to his infiltrator program was its crawler function, which went into the location, then both copied and categorized the data before downloading it. After his weeks of constant work and never-ending pizza, Mikkel's task was complete. He contacted Black, and the delivery date was confirmed. And now, Mr. Black sat in front of him. But just as White's name was not White, Black's name was not Black. His name was Mohammed Mehdi Mobasheri. He'd arrived from Tehran via Beirut the day before for this meeting, after having spent the past year cultivating Mikkel on the technology forums, while simultaneously confirming his position and access with L3 Communications. This was just the first step of Mohammed's plan, approved by the Supreme Leader, but the rest of the plan hinged on the obese, amoral, and obviously godless American seated on the dirty bed in front of him. As soon as Eddie left the room to stand on the mezzanine and smoke, Mohammed said, "Thank you. Now, do you have the infiltration drive? Do you have the money ready to wire?" He tapped his laptop. "I can do it myself instantly, as soon as I have the device." Mikkel nodded, crossed the little room, and reached behind a lamp on the table next to the TV. From behind it, he pulled out a yellow thumb drive and held it up. Mohammed looked at it closely. On it were several block letters in different colors. He cocked his head.
"I'm sorry. What does this mean? NASCAR?" "Yeah, I didn't figure you Frenchies would know about the National Association for Stock Car Auto Racing."
"No.
It's just a decoy. Somebody sees this dumb-looking thumb drive and they're not gonna think it's got anything important on it."
Mikkel grinned at his own cleverness.
"Right? But the truth is, this isn't some little thumb drive. This is a 1.2 terabyte HyperX drive. It's got the infiltrator loaded on it, and the downloaded files are stored right on board. You can get hundreds of thousands of files on a TB of drive space."
"I see," replied Mohammed.
Mikkel said, "Okay, I've said it before and I'll say it again. Truth in advertising and full disclosure and all that shit. With this device, you won't be able to do a damn thing. You'll need to be on the network. I'm talking physically. This drive needs to go into a port in a node that is already past the firewalls. Then the program will go out, round up and categorize the data, and exfiltrate it."
"This is not a problem."
Mikkel kept talking. He was a computer scientist. Precision was paramount to him, even in a situation like this.
"Only other thing you could do theoretically, I guess, would be to find someone with access to a VPN. That's a virtual private network. If they could get past all the extra security steps to log on to Interlink from outside the wire, then you could use this remotely."
Mohammed took the drive in his hands and looked at it more closely. He ignored what Mikkel said and asked a question of his own.
"You have been away from your position for several months.
How do you know they have not changed things in a manner that will make this program obsolete?
Mikkel shook his head with another grin. He was supremely sure of himself.
That's the beauty of the government, kid. The contracts for L3 and the other companies have been renewed, and they're a matter of public record. I know what systems are in place, because they are the only systems that can do the job. Sure, they'll change passwords and access codes and protocols for admittance, but they can't change the nuts and bolts of data retrieval.
And what about encryption? If you pull data off the servers, how can you be certain it is readable?
The data is not encrypted at rest, meaning where it is stored. If you have the key to get into the data, then the data is readable. It's as simple as that.
I see.
Mohammed opened his computer and slipped the drive into the port.
I will evaluate your code. If it looks good, I'll authorize the wire transfer right here and now. We will conclude our business.
Sounds good to me.
For the next 30 minutes, Mikkel watched while Mr. Black scanned through the directories. Mohammed's technical know-how was insufficient to create this himself. It would take someone like Mikkel and his years of experience building and maintaining the architecture. But the Iranian knew logical code when he saw it, and he searched down to the source code level for red flags that would indicate Mikkel had cut corners or left out necessary bits that would keep his program from actually working. He asked a few questions of the American, who answered helpfully. Finally, Mohammed ejected the device from his computer and said,
I am satisfied. Thank you.
No, Black, thank you. It was a hell of a lot of work. But now comes the fun part. Go ahead and wire the rest of the money.
Mohammed closed his laptop, put everything in his backpack, and stood from the desk.
The money, Mikkel repeated.
Mohammed held his hands up in apology.
There is no more money.
The fat man on the bed seemed genuinely confused.
What do you mean there's no money? There better be a fucking lot of money.
I do hope you spend the 100,000 doing something enjoyable. There will be no further transfer.
Mikkel's eyes went wide now. He did not sense danger, only a double cross.
Look, Black, you seem to forget. I brought back up. Don't fuck with me or things are gonna get ugly.
He turned to the door.
Eddie!
The door to the room opened quickly, and the big X-tight end filled the doorway to the landing. But only for a moment. Mikkel saw the ragged hole in his friend's forehead, just as his head drooped, and then Eddie fell face first into the room. The back of his skull was all but gone. Brain matter and blood were matted in the hair around another ragged hole, but this one was 10 times larger than the one in his forehead. Mikkel looked at the body, then up in the doorway. Eddie had been held up by 2 men who now stood on the landing. They were much smaller than Eddie, but they were still much larger than Black, who now stood right next to Philip Mikkel. The 2 new men stepped into the room. While Mikkel sat on the bed, still disoriented by the quick turn of events, one of the 2 men reached under his black leather coat and pulled out a long pistol with a silencer on the end of it. He lifted it to Mikkel's forehead. Mohammed did not know the actual names of his 4 Quds bodymen. There was no official reason for this. Their identities were not above the security clearance of a major in the Revolutionary Guards. Instead, Mohammed had told the men when he met them in Tehran to give him the name of the city of their births, and he would call them by the city. It was easier for him to remember, he explained. So Mohammed knew the 4 men only as Shiraz, Kashan, Ormond, and Isfahan. They, in turn, knew him only as Mohammed, which was quite easy for them to remember, as 2 of the 4 Quds men were named Mohammed themselves. Mohammed nodded to Shiraz and Kashan, then moved from his chair at the desk, and he sat next to the fat American on the bed.
Philip.
Yes.
I know who you are. Philip Mikkel. Age 43, unmarried, unemployed. Now is the time for you to realize your situation. You will not be paid, but you can still choose to walk away from this with your life. I truly hope that is the choice you make.
Mikkel's face had gone white. In Farsi, Mohammed spoke to Shiraz. We wait a moment, and he'll die on his own. The men remained stone-faced, not laughing at the quip. Mikkel heard the words, then coughed out a hoarse question.
You're an Arab?
Mohammed looked at the other two men. In English, he said, Americans. No cultural understanding. He turned back to Mikkel. I am from the Islamic Republic of Iran. Not an Arab, a Persian.
You are not with Anonymous?
Mohammed shrugged, smiled in apology. Sometimes I am, when it is convenient to my work. They and other groups like them are, what is the term? Useful idiots. Mohammed threw another big shoulder shrug, a show of contrition. Not unlike yourself.
What do you want?
Oh, actually,
I have what I want. You already gave it to me. I only now need to know that it will work. We expect to attempt the breach in the next 48 hours. You will be kept right here. My friends will stay with you. If there is any problem with the breach, any problem, they will be ordered to punish you and to take their time doing it. I hope it doesn't come to this.
Oh, my God.
I will leave. And when I know if your software worked as described, I will contact my friends here and give them one of two orders. You live on, or you die so very slowly and unpleasantly.
Mikkel's eyes clouded, and his lips trembled.
So you see, I am leaving now with the drive, and this is your last chance to tell me if you left anything out, put anything in, or did anything to it to render it ineffective.
Now, Philip Mikkel began crying. Mohammed looked on uncomfortably for nearly a minute. Eventually, Mikkel spoke, between sobs and gurgles of mucus in his throat.
It's not a trap. I swear to God it will work.
He put his head in his hands and began blubbering openly.
Please, please let me go.
Mohammed just winced in discomfort. Then he glanced to Shiraz. In Farsi, he said, I believe him. Shiraz nodded, stepped forward, and pressed the tip of his Glock's suppressor on the top of the seated man's head. Mikkel pulled his hands away from his face quickly, and he started to scream, but the Quds Force operative shot him at point-blank range. He dropped dead onto the floor at the foot of the bed. Blood dripped from his mouth and nostrils, and the Iranians began their work. Shiraz and Kashan collected the personal belongings of the two dead Americans, removing anything that could be used to identify them. Then they lifted both men off the floor and laid them on the king-size bed. While this was going on, Mohammed stood close to the wall by the bathroom, his eyes fixed on the bodies. While he gazed at the dead men, he used his mobile phone to call in Isfahan, who appeared in the doorway with a pair of 2-liter soda bottles in his hands. He opened the first bottle and began pouring gasoline on the bed, and handed off the other bottle to Kashan, who took it and poured it all over the bodies, taking care to thoroughly soak every stitch of clothing. When they were finished with their work, Shiraz addressed the commander of the operation.
Mohammed, you should go to the car. Ormand is waiting. We will be right behind.
Mohammed shook his head, still looking at the bodies.
Give me the lighter. I want to do it.
Sir, there are a lot of fumes. It will go up quickly. Better you...
Mohammed reached a hand out.
Please. I want to do it.
Shiraz looked at the others. With a shrug, he said,
Sure. Of course.
But stand in the open doorway and throw it in. The flames can be unpredictable.
The three Quds Force operatives went out onto the landing and checked the area. Then they looked down to make sure Ormond was still there, behind the wheel of the running Chrysler four-door. When they were satisfied everything was in order, Shiraz pulled his Zippo lighter from his pocket and held it out to Mohammed.
Are you sure?
He asked.
Of course. Why not?
Mohammed took the lighter with a quavering hand, and he did as the Quds Force operative suggested, standing in the doorway, then tossing the burning lighter onto the bed. It erupted in flame and light, and Mohammed stood there watching for several seconds as the bodies were engulfed in the inferno.
Sir, Shiraz said from behind, we must leave immediately.
Mohammed observed the fast-moving fire, the death, and the destruction he had wrought, up until the moment Shiraz put his hand on his arm and pulled him gently out of the doorway. Then the Quds officer shut the door to the room, already fully engulfed from the bathroom at the back to the curtains in the front window, and he pushed the little Revolutionary Guards major toward the stairwell, the other two body men leading the way. 15. Ethan Ross jogged through the high-dollar streets of Georgetown in a frigid pre-dawn, passing townhomes and chic stores and coffee shops not yet open for the day. There were several runners on the pavement with him, even now at 6 a.m. Like Ethan, most wore expensive running shoes and cold-weather compression pants and base layers and gloves. Virtually no one was over 40, and virtually everyone had earbuds in their ears. But as far as Ethan was concerned, the similarities ended there. He doubted any of them had Joan Baez pumping through their headphones like he did. He also seriously doubted any of the other runners here in Georgetown planned on going by a predetermined point in the neighborhood to hunt for a secret signal indicating that the meeting in the woods for later in the morning was a go. Ethan had not slept well at all. His polygraph was set for 3 p.m., and although he knew objectively he had the skills he needed to beat it, his armor had always been his impenetrable confidence. His armor had been administered a hell of a blow, and this unfamiliar insecurity resulted in his bout of nerves and poor sleep. At 6:10, he passed the green fire hydrant in front of the Gap Kids on the corner of Wisconsin and N Street. He glanced at it quickly as he jogged by. He thought he saw the telltale chalk mark, but he wasn't certain, so he pulled up his run and came to a full stop. He stood there, feigned an air of nonchalance as he pretended to stretch his calves by leaning against the hydrant, and while doing so he leaned down and examined it carefully. Yes, a distinct white chalk mark had been made across the top of the iron device. His plan had been to continue up N Street and make a big loop back to his place, but now that he knew he had to meet with Banfield before work, he cut his run short and turned to head back up Wisconsin. It was laughable tradecraft, but no one was watching, and he got away with it. Ethan arrived at Fort Marcy Park at 8 a.m., and he parked in the little lot a few spaces down from Harlan Banfield's Volkswagen. He climbed out of his Mercedes, then marched quickly through the frosty morning up the hill with his hands deep in the pockets of his wool trench coat. The trail to the rendezvous point wound up and around a thick copse of trees, so it wasn't until Ross rounded the turn that he stopped dead in his tracks. Harlan Banfield was there, standing by the cannon, and he was not alone. With him was a woman with long, curly black hair. She wore a black coat and stood with her hands deep in her pockets.
Vapor from her breathing hung around her face, obscuring her appearance. Ethan felt a quick twinge of panic, and his face reddened with anger and confusion. His first thought was that the FBI was here, in the trees, and they were going to knock him to the ground and drag him off. He looked around, half expecting the ubiquitous Hollywood-generated sound of the clicking and clanking of guns as they were pointed at him. But there were no sounds, save for the rumble of a big truck rolling along Chain Bridge Road 50 yards on through the woods. Banfield called out to Ross, his hand up and waving him forward. "It's okay, Ethan. Everything is fine. Come over here. I have someone I'd like you to meet." Ethan wanted to turn away and run back to his car, but he saw no chance of escape if this was a trap. He forced himself to continue to the cannon and the two people waiting for him there. He was all the way up to the woman before he recognized her. He'd seen her on TV and on the internet, and he'd once seen her in person in Berlin. She extended her hand, and Ethan shook it. "My name is Gianna Bartoli." "I know who you are." His anger subsided quickly, but his concern remained. As he looked once again into the trees, he said, "I saw your film. I admire the work you do for the cause." She smiled. "Thank you. But it is you who deserves admiration." After an uncomfortable silence, the three of them sat down on the small bench. Ethan coughed nervously. "I hope to hell you haven't come to film a documentary about all this." She shook her head with a smile. "No, of course not. I just arrived from Geneva last night. I'm here to personally assure you we are going to take care of you throughout this investigation." "Then I guess that makes you the head of the International Transparency Project." Her smile widened, and she nodded. "While working on the documentary, I got an intimate look at every aspect of the project. I met all the players. I grew to respect the work they did. As it happened, I was asked to take over the reins after the former director fell into ill health, and it was an honor to do so." She beamed. She was as charming as he remembered her from Berlin. "It's a role that is both eased and complicated by my film work." Ethan breathed vapor into the cold morning. "You are here because Harlan told you about the polygraph." She smiled. "He mentioned it. And I know he also mentioned that you will beat the polygraph as soon as you realize you have nothing to hide." "With apologies, Ms. Bartoli, I do have something to hide. But it is not guilt, and it's nothing to be ashamed of. You had no role in what happened in India. I am here to guarantee you of that. It was just bad luck. Bad luck for everyone." Banfield reached into his coat and pulled out three small and plain plastic bottles, each one containing several pills. He said, "These will help. The first two are sertraline and clonazepam. They will relax you. You'll want to take the pills this morning as soon as you can to see how they affect you. Test your speech. A good polygraph examiner can tell if you're doping up to beat the box. Just take one each. This should not overly sedate you. Take one more of each a half hour before the exam." "And the other bottle?" "Glycopyrrolate. It will inhibit your ability to perspire. Take two pills now, and that should cover you for the rest of the day." Ethan took the pill bottles from Banfield and slipped them into the pocket of his wool coat, but his eyes remained on the Swiss woman. "You wouldn't have come if you weren't concerned. You think I'll fail, don't you?" "On the contrary, if you get arrested, you will be a lost cause to me. If I thought you were a lost cause, I wouldn't be here. I have every intention of getting you extricated from this short-term problem and back to the important work you are doing. We have much invested in you at the project. We have a lot of whistleblowers working for us." She gave him a half wink. "But you
or our rock star. Ethan considered himself impervious to the charms of others. Working as a diplomat, he'd dealt with hundreds of people in his career who attempted to use their charisma to captivate and thereby control him. Such tactics rarely worked on Ethan. But Bertoli was different. She conveyed at once an air that was sexy, motherly, intelligent, and compassionate. She transmitted an appearance of calm control. Ethan found himself drawn to her magnetism. She said, "I want you to know we are prepared to go to whatever lengths are necessary, with no restrictions at all, to protect you. Whistleblowers like you merit our services for as long as you need them." She added, "You will be safe." "Thank you. However, there is something you can do to help yourself." "What is that?" "Create an ace in the hole." "I don't understand." Bertoli smiled at him, sympathetic, compassionate. "Yes, you do. I am talking about you taking some information of a sensitive nature from the files where you work. Something damning. And then you encrypt it and keep it ready to use as a get-out-of-jail-free card if the need arises." Ethan Ross looked off into the woods. You were talking about a scrape." Banfield looked back and forth between the two of them. "A scrape?" Ross said, "She wants me to pull every bit of classified data I can get my hands on, store it on a portable and protected device of some sort." His voice cracked. "And then run with it." "No," she said, "you don't need to run now, but you need to be ready. It is the only way, Ethan. Obtaining something from the files of a classified nature that, if revealed, could be more trouble to the American government than they are prepared to deal with. I'm not talking about sharing it with anyone, not even me. No, this is just for you, just for your own safety. If you need to protect yourself, you can have it ready to wave under their nose." "I'm not that naive, Ms. Bertoli. If the FBI finds out about what I did, then I am fucked." "It's Gianna. And it's naive to think the FBI doesn't turn the other cheek when a target creates more trouble than he's worth. I've seen it happen. They keep it quiet, of course. No one admits they dropped an investigation because a target held something over their heads, but it does happen." Ethan said, "I don't even know how to scrape." Gianna reached into her purse. "I brought something with me from Europe." She held up a yellow thumb drive, just a small plastic rectangle with a USB connector. On it was written NASCAR. Ross didn't understand why it was marked with advertising for stock car racing, but he knew exactly what it was, and his cockiness meant he needed to tell her. "That's a crawler." The Swiss woman nodded her head solemnly. Banfield was still out of the loop on this. As a journalist, he dealt with sources and leads, not computer hacking. "What does it do?" Ross answered, "Ms. Bertoli wants me to sneak this into NSC, plug it into a port on my computer. It will send a spider-like program out there and scrape data. It will then pull it all into a file on the server and exfiltrate it out." "How much data?" he asked. "That is 1.2 terabytes. Ethan whispered, "Holy shit." He looked the thumb drive over more closely. "You know it will work?" "It will work. It was created by ex-employees of the NSA. People who know how to exploit the Interlink TS network, but people without access to the system any longer." Banfield said, "So anyone who can get at a White House computer can plug that in," and Ethan cut him off. "No, you need the right administration access."
Gianna said, "And we know you can get that access. We've been very impressed with your computer skills." Ethan sighed. "You will insult my intelligence if you pretend you don't know I am dating an IT security expert working for a government contractor." Gianna's smile now turned upon